The title of today's show and Inside the Black Box is Neurohumanities.
And make that sound like you know what you're talking about.
No, I have no idea what that is. And our guest to explain what that is a visiting distinguished professor here at Georgia Tech, Barbara Stafford. Barbara, what are the neurohumanities?
They don't exist yet, which is why we're doing a conference and a neurosalon. They are an idea whose time has come.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen. Neurohumanities, an idea whose time has come. And we are so far out in front of the pack. You will hear it next up on Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.
If you like big band jazz, you'll love the DeSoto Hour. Airing Saturdays from 6 to 8 p.m., we'll play old school big band standards from the good old days and much more. So set your radio dial to 91.1 FM WREK Atlanta. Saturdays from 6 to 8 for the DeSoto Hour.
See rock and roll as youth culture, and when youth culture becomes monopolized by big business, what are the youth to do? Do you have any idea? I think we should destroy the bogus capitalist process that is destroying youth culture.
For the best in indie rock and hipster pop, tune into Gold Sounds every Tuesday night at 6 p.m. only on WREK Atlanta.
Of course, this is Stewie Griffin here to tell you that the opinions reflected on Inside the Black Box do not necessarily reflect those of WREK Atlanta and the Georgia Institute of Technology.
Pete, I'm so glad my headphones were going in and out just then, because that spared me what I think was a Family Guy
so
reference.
So we got the disclaimer, but we might get sued for...
Yeah, we might. But, you know, that is my incarnation of that particular character.
Okay. I actually heard an interview with Seth MacFarlane, and it sounds like he would be glad for you to... break his copyright.
Okay. All right. So we can live with that. We just keep losing that liner.
It comes back.
It's like the mystery liner.
I just don't care enough to find it mostly.
All right. There it is. The level of professionalism we've come to expect from Trent on a regular basis. So the title of today's program is Neurohumanities. And I will not do Dr. Barbara Stafford's CV justice by pointing out simply that she is its visiting distinguished professor at Georgia Tech. Is that the current title?
Yes.
And when the distinguished, you get like a free coupon for a latte with that?
No, I wish I did. That goes with that? I wish I did.
So now you did your Bachelor of Arts degree at Northwestern University, majoring in continental philosophy and comparative literature. Right. You also spent a year at the Sorbonne in Paris studying Plato. You studied a whole bunch of things. I couldn't even begin to scratch the surface. Then you eventually returned to Northwestern for a master's in art history. And you found philosophy, and I love this, not enfleshed. So an engineering boob like myself would say, I didn't find it meaty enough. Is that what not enfleshed enough means?
It means at that time, analytic philosophy was really on the rise, as it continues to be, although I'm going back. I mean, I've never given up my philosophical roots, mm-hmm. as will become, I hope will become evident, because phenomenology is now back in a very important way for those of us interested in embodied and embedded thinking, and especially visualization became important to me at that point.
And
I'm a visualist.
When
you
say analytical philosophy, we mean the logical mathematical side.
Yes, exactly, which has also become very, very important for what's called the new philosophy of mind. But continental philosophy, which is what I studied, Northwestern was quite famous for it at the time, is also very important, particularly because of Merleau-Ponty and the phenomenological strain. And it's interesting that both of those strands are now really focusing on what can be called embodied cognition, embodied and embedded cognition. So that's still an interest.
And I'm going to learn exactly what those are in but a
not
moment.
Not yet.
At what, at what point in that, Pete, did you actually find yourself falling?
No, I think I was stabilized by the fact that I was watching you come up with a last-minute protocol to deal with. Whose cell phone was ringing? Was that yours?
Well, let's not give the guest a problem here.
Throw it out. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, that's quite all right. No, listen, we're just having a discussion. No, I thought it was Charlie's, and rather than turning it off, he was sort of covering the microphone.
No, my cell phone actually makes a noise that can't be broadcast.
Maybe so Trent could throw it out the door. Trent, just throw it outside the door. My apologies.
So, no, that's quite all right. So, and then you've taught and lectured all over the world, but for a lot of the past 20 years, you've actually taught at University of Chicago.
Right.
And for the last decade, held a university chair there.
Right.
What made you come to Georgia Tech?
Ah, what a wonderful question. Well, I was first
Central,
of all,
as we call it.
Okay. What a wonderful question. I first of all, of course, I was invited, but secondly, because all of my work, which I'm happy to talk about later in the program, but all of my work has really been at the intersection of the arts and sciences, beginning actually with the geological sciences and with a book called Voyage into Substance, looking at travel literature and especially the great scientific voyages of discovery and the way that the artists contributed to those campaigns through biology, biophilia, and actually I see cognitive sciences really as an extension of that long project.
Yeah. But that doesn't explain why Georgia Tech.
Georgia Tech, because I'm very mindful that what I've really been arguing for, that the arts and sciences really have to speak to one another at a deep level and with respect in establishing, let's say, common issues or issues in common, it seemed to me Georgia Tech was the place. It is, as President Peterson reminds us, supposed to be the technological university of the future, the template, the model.
Wow, you got suckered.
I did. Well, that's what he said.
I couldn't agree more.
I know you're teasing, but all of that rhetoric aside, I think this is, and it's something I want to say, I mean, about your first question, what is this thing called the neurohumanities? I really do believe it's an idea whose time has come. That is that the humanities, or let's call it the liberal arts, the visual arts, because I'm always on the visual side of things, as well as the social sciences and the so-called hard sciences. It's really a moment for coming together around common issues. I mean, that's certainly true, I think. I think we in the humanities are slowly waking up to the fact that the issues that we used to think were our own, that is memory, creativity, imagination, are now actually the rather humanistic problems of the neurosciences or the so-called emerging brain sciences. Yeah. I mean, this is a paradox, but a wonderful moment of opportunity.
And tech has been lurching towards this for about 20 years.
Lurching is the operative word.
Lurching.
It has not been an elegant progression.
A monster stitched together. But the STAC program and everything going
from
on
from which Charlie graduated.
Oh, you graduated from
Stack.
Yeah. Sure, I know.
You're deep in that, the
yes,
belly
of
that
course.
Beast. Yeah, but early on, you know, the classes like Writers in the Age of Freud, Writers in the Age of Galileo, which were trying to examine a cultural moment and the science that came out of it, or a scientific moment and the culture that came out of it. But it's always funny to me to realize that Georgia Tech was on the leading edge of that for a long time, and we are a school full of engineers who feel they have no use for the humanities and full of STAC majors who think that they're super cool because they're not engineers.
Yeah, and that's most unfortunate because I think the future is going to lie in collaboration and actually in defining a richer research project. That is, I think, the visual arts in particular. I'll say this. I probably hopefully get some angry phone calls here, but that the problem, I think, when the neurosciences do engage the humanities, it's usually the linguistic side.
Right.
It's cognitive linguistics. I'm thinking of, although there are people, of course, Gerald Edelman, Antonio Damasio, we know, could have been a world-class pianist. Let me say, larger than language, the sensory-based media, non-discursive, like your program last week, you know, the lovely metaphor program
exactly.
at Emory.
Music,
music that's non-discursive, and there are people like Philip Lieberman, a cognitive psychologist, who points out the importance of rhythm, your rhythmia, dance, because of the close association of the visual and the motor cortex. But just to get back to your point, I think we can't inhabit these distinctive worlds anymore. At least there's this opportunity to come together more enticingly in a richer fashion around common questions, particularly in an era when there's so much cost-cutting and the tendency is to use the MEDAX approach. You know, we'll just cut you, we'll cut you. Whereas wouldn't it be more interesting if we said, well, we actually want to form a program. We want to come together in a new way and shape issues in a different way. So I think this has programmatic repercussions as well. At least I would hope so. So the conference, in a way, is an attempt to demonstrate. I'm a big demonstrator. I'm not about just talking.
That is a smart avenue to proceed upon because we're engineers. We like to see an example. So when you think about it, so I could not agree more that there is a juxtaposition of these two things such that humanities can help science and engineering. Engineering can help science and can help engineering and science can help humanities. And I have my own personal examples where I work with, say, Lou Lefton, who's been on this program before, to use humorous improvisation to explore idea space for technical innovation. To me, that's an example of that. But can you give us an example of this juxtaposition between, you know, science and neuroscience and humanities that even engineers, as Charlie pointed out before, who are a little anal retentive and don't necessarily believe in the value of this kind of
I don't think I used the word retentive.
I used it. So the point is...
Sure.
I'll be giving words in Charlie's mouth all day long.
Sure. Well, let me take one key example. It's one that means a lot. I think I'm teaching a neuroaesthetics graduate seminar right now for my sins. But anyway...
Okay, wait. I'm going to stop you right there. What's the class again?
And it's called neuroaesthetics. Neuroaesthetics.
I'm writing this down.
And why do you feel like perhaps this is penance for...
I just meant it's actually an exciting class, but it's a class, again, for which one has to argue and make, really, where I bring, you know, different people. The ideal would be to bring different people from across campus together, which means that you've got to raise them up and... As I said, I believe in intellectual parity. At the University of Chicago, I was a member of the workshop for computational neuroscience, for cognition, because it's one thing to read somebody like V.S. Ramachandran. It's quite another thing to understand the experiments. And so I really believe you have to bring yourself up to a certain level. Shoot the question to me again. I've got to.
It was Pete's question.
Pete's question. Give me
what
your
was question,
again.
Can we take an example?
Sorry, I'm a wayward thinker.
Engineers understand by example. That I've learned from teaching.
Yes, sorry.
Just one example that might illustrate that.
Sure, and it's one that came up yesterday from the architectural students, from the College of Architecture students, which is, I put to them, what's the most important thing for you in terms of these neuronal developments and the possibility for collaboration in your own design projects? And the example they gave was mirror neurons, the whole notion. I mean, this goes back to Rizzolatti in the early 1990s, the experiments with macaque monkeys that shows how we virtually internalize another's gesture without being conscious of it. In other words, it's not yet at the higher levels of consciousness. And it is then this kind of universal tendency to take in the world in motion, and that's how we come to understand, which of course opens up the entire humanities side of the discussion, Aristotle on mimesis, on theories of imitation, mm-hmm. which of course suggests an enormous opportunity to kind of rethink the mirror neuron side of things from the perspective of this very long aesthetic and artistic discourse mm-hmm. On mimesis, mimicry, biomimicry, the Yerkes Center, for example, all of these things. So I would say that would be a very concrete example around, say, issues of mirroring, imitation, something, by the way, speaking of newer media, which we did before the radio show started, something that gets lost in the age of simulation, the fact that imitation is actually not simulation. Copying is not, there are these nuanced differences of formats that, you know, that to say that something is like something else or similar to something else isn't the same as a Xerox hard copy, or it's not the same as a VR simulation. And somehow these subtle concepts of imitation perhaps might inflect scientific research on not just visual mirroring, there's also acoustic mirroring, and vice versa. So that would be a very concrete example.
Go ahead, Charles.
So mutual research.
Do you feel like, I mean, is there a balance, or is one side getting more connection than the other? Are the architecture students getting more to develop what they're doing by hearing about the science, or are the scientists going to get more from what they're doing by connecting it to a humanities discipline?
At the moment, I would say it depends on the individual. It really depends on the individual. I know some wonderful, wonderful scientists who are perhaps more humanistic. The humanists are not going to like this, but perhaps more humanistic than humanities people have become in some ways. On the other hand, that is, they're open-minded. And the same thing could be said for the humanities. There are many different, everybody has camps. You know, there are camps in the neurosciences, you know, there for sure are, as well as in the humanities. I think if one got, again, I keep coming back to being issue-driven. Another one that I would give that to you, another example, if I might, that you said would interest engineers, is the problem of physical representation and design. But physical representation, not conceived as it might have been in the cognitive sciences in the 1980s, but the way Andy Clark, for example, in Being There, a kind of whole new cognitive science that, again, he argues is distributed, it's embodied, it's embedded, that suggests an entirely different performative attitude. I think there, actually, my continental philosophy would come in, phenomenology. There is a whole new phenomenology out there that speaks, actually kind of goes back to American pragmatism, to people like James, that it's not so much about a subject and an object, but it's about the event, the situation, the subject-object situation. That you therefore design quite differently, and you design across the board quite differently.
Okay, so the stuff you're talking about right now is making me think of Artaud.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And so,
of course,
Artaud and his fascination with representation, which eventually led to him. I think you can kind of draw a straight line that he went from being interested in representation into art, in art, and then ended up a crazy person with no teeth banging on a drum. Right.
Sounds like some of my friends.
Yeah, you know, maybe with a few extra teeth for your friends. So Artaud is this almost, he is a tragic figure, and he's almost ridiculous. You know, if you try to get into what's going on with Artaud and what he has presented as a philosophy, if you try to say to someone what this guy is working on is important to your discipline, probably you'll get some pushback. If you went to an architecture student and you said, In designing your buildings, you should also think about this limit of representation and this response from a person at the limits of representation into the sublime, into a performative aspect, they'd probably say, dude, I'm just trying to get it from one side to the other. You know, what are you going to try and put into my work with this crazy person? Right?
Okay.
That's like the extreme example that I can think
okay.
of.
Okay. May I, before I lose the train, not having mm-hmm. eaten my sandwich yet.
Are you starving the guest, Pete?
Not that I know of.
No. It's good. It's good. It energizes me.
Keeps us on the edge.
Let me answer you first by an example and then answer you actually by something else. First of all, in the seminar yesterday, I asked the students to entirely reconceive what it means of what an architectural facade might mean if you come at it from the history of portraiture. If you think of the fusiform face, if you think of the portrait, can you conceive of the face of a building in an entirely different way? Which brings me to your second crazy point. I want to state categorically that one of the deepest things that connects the visual arts and the sciences is the fact that they are actually rule-based, that there is, and historically, there have been, the Romantics had grammars of expression.
Right.
There were, that there is a logic to art. In the Artaud case, I would say that if you have a rule-based predicated actually on some of these cognitive rules, on some of our hardwiring. If you have that, then you can thwart those rules. And in a way, Artaud very well understood that we have certain primal instinctual reactions to axial symmetry, to the vertical stance. Buffon knew that in the late 18th century, that we see the visual array a particular way because it's predicated on the vertical stance. In cyberspace, that's going mm-hmm. to be a, you know, we need a new definition. So I would say that you can only flaunt certain conventions if actually you have rules. And I'd like to get that on the table, that art is not just a free-for-all.
So we need to take a quick break, but let me see if I can summarize before we do.
Yeah, I need to wipe off that
now. I know what it feels like, right? So the biggest criticism that we get hammered for in the sciences is jargon. And there was a lot of jargon thrown at me. I'm very confused. I'm you can't see this now. I'm in the fetal position on the floor now.
But
see, to us as engineers, we have that as an issue. But I could not agree more that they are rule-based. And once we get beyond, jargon is easy to get beyond. We just simply have to talk and learn each other's jargon. Let me see if I can take your example about mimicry.
Sure.
And explain it so that I can understand it, so that my students can understand it. So you talked about copying and simulation. So I'm a simulator, right? I simulate glassy polymers and polymer photoresists and RNA fragments and things like that.
You simulate tenure?
Yeah, I do. I simulate a respected member of the scientific community as well. The point is, people think we simulate to copy and that our goal is to completely reproduce the physical system. And you're absolutely right. That's not it. Our goal is much more like the artist, to take our representation. And our representation is different than the actual copy, but our representation gives something that the copy doesn't. It gives an insight that might inspire in the humanities, but an insight that will tell us, well, what if we change the side group on the polymer? What if we change the backbone rigidity? It actually allows you to take your incarnation and experiment with that. So in my mind, that is absolutely correct. And I agree, and this is something I want to explore when we come back from the break. Rule-based, right? So just last week, we were talking about a music expression of the evolution of molecules.
Yes.
And we talked, so I play the trumpet, I'm a jazz improviser, and the idea of modal jazz traversing through the same key versus sure. 3-5-7 chord structure, and you look at painting and perspective and lines and things like that, it's very rule-based. So let's take a look at that when we come back from the break. And if you are listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1 and have a question or comment about this topic, by all means, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
The following is a public service announcement brought to you by WREK Atlanta. On April 20th through the 23rd, the city of Atlanta will be hosting its 76th annual Atlanta Dogwood Festival. The festival will be held at Piedmont Park, which will be a sight to see as the dogwoods will be in full bloom. For more information on the events and times, visit www.dogwood.org. It can be suave. It can be fast. It can be experimental. But it's always just jazz, and you can hear it every weekday from 9 to noon right here on WREK.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box. Well, the title of today's program is Neurohumanities, and chatting with us today is Barbara Stafford, visiting distinguished professor here at Georgia Tech, who is going to tell us about something that does not exist. That's how cutting edge we are, the neurohumanities. And the one common link that we established in the first portion of the program is both science engineering and the humanities are rule-based. So does that help, you know, sort of bring these two things together? I mean, how does neurohumanities work in that context? Do we exchange rules? Do we observe that we have common rules and try to use them for the betterment of the other side, from the other side? Or I'm yammering
on
now.
May I say a little bit of history?
Yes.
This argument requires some persuasion of the humanities side of things. And I'm now speaking as a humanist, a kind of weird art historian, what I think we've forgotten is that there were these there was E.H. Gombrich in the 1960s, who was very interested in psychology and art. There was the art and mathematics group. There was Georgie Kepisch at MIT, who was interested in actually the relationship between logic, mathematics, and the visual arts. There were a whole batch of people actually even coming out of the Bauhaus, the Russian formalists in the 1930s. What happened is that the 70s happened historically, and something called the social construction of reality came about, which said that everything was socially constructed, and what got tossed out was something that got sort of dismissively called formalism. That is the notion that form and meaning, that there are intuitive responses to certain shapes and forms and colors that we share. There's a kind of, Berlin, for example, on universal color systems. What the Romantics thought when they devised grammars of expression, what Kandinsky, for example, or Mondrian believed in, that there was a kind of fundamental geometry that one understood. And what happened is we've got this about 30 or 40 year hiatus, and now when the brain sciences are just coming in making these arguments, we've got some catching up to do, because those people from the 60s and 70s who were interested in this stuff sort of disappeared from the scene, and now we need them. Now we're connecting back to those strands, but it requires an argument on the humanities side as well.
You're teaching me something very interesting here, and I think of my colleagues over in ISYE, Industrial Systems and Engineering, and other people that work on human-machine interfaces.
Sure.
And I do a lot of computing because I'm a simulator. And, you know, people discuss the fact that certain shapes, certain arrangements, geometries, colors, the way you put together the human-machine interface really makes a difference, not on how cute it looks, although
no.
that is an issue, on how effective and engaging it is.
Emotional that, affect, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And the point is, I thought that was new, and what you're saying is, no, we just lost it in the 70s.
We lost it. I think we lost it in the 70s, at least, and I'm not, please, I'm not denying that there are cultural inputs. I'm a neural Darwinist. I go with Gerald Edelman, in case anybody out there wonders. I mean, obviously, culture is important, but there are certain things that are indeed... that it fascinated, that I like to call the logic of art. And by the way, it's not just visual art. Mm-hmm. People who study lyric poetry now also speak of a kind of new formalism, not the old one that got that was considered just for aesthetes, but actually pattern recognition. If we think of all the work on pattern recognition, pattern generation, pattern recognition in computation, in synthetic biology, in all of these different areas, what is visual art but a high-order pattern?
Yeah.
And
yes.
patterns that have really high-order audiences and that also wish to, that's the performative dimension. In other words, you want a subjective response from the viewer, and they do that. So that's what I think is important.
I would
important.
Go even further. I would say we talked about, you know, improvisational jazz, and we actually have Brian McGurko, who's studying the essence of improvisation. As a stand-up comedian, there is a logic of art to both stand-up, and there's a lot of logic to humorous improv. There are actually rules, and they are written down in a book somewhere. And people tend to believe that stand-up comedians are just guys that had one too many beer that stumbled on the stage with the microphone. No.
No, there's rules that were written in Chicago, that were published and codified in Chicago. Chicago, of all places.
Yeah, the improv stuff. Second City actually has books on this sort of stuff. So I agree. So here's the question.
I mean, there's a difference between extemporaneous and improvisation. I think people forget.
Yes.
And that's
absolutely.
That even though something, look, it's like what people say, let me just use the Impressionists because everybody knows them, there's a the notion that they just kind of throw this stuff on the canvas, I mean, that's, it's actually an art form that pretends not to be labor-intensive. Mm-hmm. I happen to be interested in labor-intensive art forms, formats that make you aware that you are aware, that make you conscious that you are conscious. And that gets me back, actually, Pete, to your point, you know, when we're talking about simulation, that not all formats convey or transfer data in the same way.
Right.
And some formats actually show you that they are labor-intensive and others disguise it.
Right.
And I think, actually, when they finally find the neural correlates of consciousness and so on, that they're going to see, you know, attention and awareness, that small 10% band, you know, where we're conscious and we're conscious.
Yeah.
I want to argue that it's the visual arts, the arts that put pressure on you in that direction.
So I just learned something. So I learned stand-up comedy is like Impressionism, right? It's something that disguises the labor-intensive nature of it. And I was just talking to the students in my Living Learning community a couple days ago, and I read Little Bets. It's a book that was given to everyone that attended the College of Engineering retreat on putting together the future vision, right? Their vision for the College of Engineering. And it talked about Chris Rock. And it talked about the fact that Chris Rock tries these things out over and over again. It's very labor-intensive. It's true of any stand-up comedian. And all you have to do is go to an open mic if someone has never been with a microphone in their hand before and see what their 5 minutes looks like as opposed to a professional comedian who's worked on that for months and months and years, and they're fun, and it looks effortless, like you're making fun of the guy in the front row, but it's not.
And there's an extraordinary thing that happens when you shift from a performer who is uncomfortable, say, on the stage. Like the classic stand-up show, we're just going to keep going with stand-up, starts with an opener or two or three, right? And then a middle, and then your closer, right? Your star.
No,
right?
Usually an MC, a feature, and a headliner.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Excellent. So... There's
more jargon for you.
There's
a jargon in comedy. I'm like, we're doomed.
No, no, it's being codified as an actual relationship between audience and performer.
There are rules.
So you get your openers who are often working out jokes that are on the level of a set up punchline, you know, Henny Youngman drunk, basically, kind of jokes. And they're working it out and they're trying to feel out the audience and trying to see what's happening. And there's a deep discomfort in the audience that comes from openers who are maybe not getting it, right? when your, what did you call the middle?
The feature.
When the feature arrives and comes out confident and begins to just lay out an act that they have practiced and that, and to connect to the crowd in a way that they know, I'm just going to start and not worry about it until I get near them. There's a relaxing that happens in the audience because a person who understands the rules has arrived and is now taking us into their work, right? And no one would ever say, oh, yeah, I started enjoying it a lot more because clearly this person knew what they were doing and knew the inherent rules to stand up. You know, and I found dentist jokes and airplane food jokes funnier because this person wasn't looking to see if the jokes had landed, that they just tossed them and then continued on. And so, and then you get to your
headliner
and you've entered into the world. You know that now you're going to see this performance that follows the rules, and you give the headliner the right to break the rules. You know, the middle has the toughest job. The feature has the toughest job in a stand-up show because you don't know this person, and they've got to prove that they understand comedy, that they're different than the openers, and that it's going to be okay when the headliner comes on and breaks the rules.
Well, then it reminds you of people. I mean, then you see, I mean, this rule-based, you can think of John Cage, you know, who, for example, realized that people tended to listen to concerts better if there was a kind of scraping of chairs in the audience, because then they had to tune their hearing mechanism more to the point.
To focus
and
on
so
the
he
art.
Knew that one is attuned, as it were, to the flow of information, not anything stopping it, but there's a whole, and this is where I think the neurosciences could really benefit from us on the humanistic side, that they realize that there are these vast art forms, these formats, this whole treasure trove of formats that actually do this kind of John Cageian thing. They make you attend. One of your questions to me earlier was about what is my own work, and my own work is really whatever happened to selective attention. That is the tiny little 10% that isn't, that some marketeer hasn't decided, you know, to have some Bose filtering headset screwed onto, or
the phrase
tailor,
tailorize.
I want to listen to this music. I don't want to do this. And what about attending to the world? No wonder we're in such a hell of a mess.
And the phrase you said was "whatever happened to selective attention,"
yes,
meaning
happened.
That you think it's gone.
I think that there is that little 10% bandwidth is a really expensive piece of real estate that has been grabbed. And I would like to see the humanities take it back with this kind of mindful art, with these mindful art formats that actually make you, first of all, attend to our environment, attend to our world, and also attend to things. I just gave a lecture in the Mind, Brain, and Culture Center at Emory on slow looking. I mean, the importance of slow looking, of hesitating. The look, and what I did is I just amassed a group of images from the wide range of the history of art, extremely contemporary media, very different kinds of formats, and said, you know, neuroscientists work from the inside out, but what if you ask the question from the outside in? What does the look of mindfulness look like? What is the look of reflection? How do we look when we, in our styles of thought, and what can be learned from that about internal processes? For example, if you think of language, pondering, the French, that suggests weight. There's a kind of heaviness in the body, in the physiology. These kind of nuances I'd kind of like to bring back to our little 10% and say that's what, to kind of say it's important when we're conscious that we are, that we're aware, and not just on automatic pilot, you know, on all those mechanisms. You know, I think the estimate now is that 90% of our neural machinery is really like the homeostatic system. That's not our neural machinery, but like the homeostatic system is really functioning autonomously. In other words, you know, automatically, we're not really aware. And I want to save, carve out that tiny little 10% where we are aware.
So what
and
you
the formats
saying
that
is
make us aware.
This 10% that we used to use to discern, to think about, to ponder, now it has been taken over by, let's use the internet example, which we talked about a little before. We live in this giant filter bubble of Google and all sorts of other things deciding what we should look at. And when you're cognizant of that fact, it actually makes me a better searcher of literature. So I'll go off to databases, but occasionally I will use Google Scholar, which is actually quite good. But I realize that Google Scholar, Google in general, and other things, this isn't just Google, and they're trying to do it to help me. They are already filtering what I get out of it, and I will actually use colleagues' logins or wipe out every cookie I've ever had, but that won't help you at all because they keep track of the history of those cookies, right?
I don't let my students use Google. Let me tell you, no Google searches because no data bits, because they suffer under the illusion that all databases are infinite.
Yes, exactly.
And that
they're similar and they have a similar criteria.
Yes.
They are all filtering things in a certain way. And I realize it's very different if I go into my daughter's login or my login, it will be different. If you're cognizant of that fact, you can better interpret what you're getting back.
Yeah, and you realize that you're getting a fragment.
Yes, yes.
That you are
and a biased fragment at that.
A biased fragment, and you are bringing your higher order consciousness, really, to work on that. I think that's actually where they're going to finally, it's in that tiny little bandwidth that they're finally going to solve, you know, what they're, you know, the neural correlates of consciousness. I mean, I think that's where it's going to, and they're going to need us. I mean, I think they're going to need us from the visual side of things and the humanistic side of things to help with that.
I'd like to tell a very quick personal anecdote that I think connects to this, and it's another issue that we're going to have to grapple with. So I pulled from my bookshelf a very short introduction to a particular thinker. It was just one of those books that kind of catch your eye, and you're like, I'm going to read that. We're going to get through this. It's a quick essay. And I attempted to read it over this past weekend, and it's written to summarize the thinker, to just sort of be brief, and I could not read it. And I'm supposedly an academic, right? But every sentence sent my mind off.
Yeah.
And I could actually sort of feel the metaphorical browser windows open.
Got it.
In an attempt to search for more.
So you were reading regular text in hypertext.
Exactly.
Yes, I see what you're saying.
And because I was reading it with the expectation of some kind of hypertextual element, 40 pages took like 6 days. You know, and I don't remember half of it.
But it's a problem of focusing.
Exactly.
I mean, every single way that we're losing this power.
Normally, I don't notice that I'm losing the focus.
Yeah, no,
though,
but that's a lovely example.
Yeah, because I'm reading on the internet, or I'm having a conversation, or because I am doing something that I feel totally comfortable having those little tangents off of. But then going to a book and just trying to read a short essay in book form, it made it explicit that my brain fires away from, you know, each of the ideas that's in the text, and that I have to rewire myself and relearn how to just read a text.
That's blatantly obvious in math textbooks. The higher you get up in math classes, the shorter the textbooks get, because in the higher the classes, they'll have like one word that's an entire other textbook that you've already read.
And they expect you to know that.
Yeah.
And otherwise, you either have to click on that hypertext
that's why
or go read that book.
Yeah, that's why the really high-level math texts are like 40 pages.
But Trent, you're also raising the whole issue of the short form, the shorter and shorter, the bit, the tweet. Again, I would make the argument that not everything is suited to a tweet. I mean, everything is
downloadable.
I didn't
say it's suited to it. I'm just saying that's the case with the math
textbooks. No, that's why I'm,
All right, we need to take another quick break, but hopefully when we'll get back, we'll try to bring this all around and understand what this new science of neurohumanities or humanities of
neurohumanities. I'm sorry, Peter, I was distracted. What are you talking about?
I said we're taking a break.
Got it, okay.
And we're going to bring it all together and realize that in another 6 months we have to do another show on this. That's what we're going to realize. But again, if you are listening to our discussion on the neurohumanities, which doesn't exist yet, but we are the very defining element, element of it right here on WRHA.
This is a strategic spot in the development of the neurohumanities, and you are there, Pete.
And if you are listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1,
a
and
pioneer.
Have a question or comment, I'll take that. That's better than what most people call me during the day. Give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Lost in the Stacks is the one and only research library rock and roll radio show.
Every Friday at noon, your co-hosts, Amit and Charlie from the Georgia Tech Library, pick a theme and free associate an hour of music, interviews, and library talk. You'll hear indie rock, pop rock, alt rock, new wave, and the occasional oddity in between interviews with students, faculty, and librarians. Whichever you tune in for, we hope you dig it. That's every Friday at noon on WREK Atlanta.
Feet up to the fire, grab a warm cup of cocoa, light your good pipe, cuddle with a loved one or a fuzzy puppy, then tune your radio to 91.1 on the FM dial.
You'll hear country, bluegrass, folk, and American traditional that you won't hear anywhere else on the radio. New music, old music, even some new music that sounds like old music.
So if you're tired of hearing pop country, another mainstream hogwash, tune into the Back Alley Pork Roost each and every Sunday night from 9 to 10 p.m.
That's the Back Alley Pork Roost, Sunday nights, 9 to 10 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta.
She's a mighty river.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Barbara Stafford, visiting distinguished professor here at Georgia Tech, who is helping us define the very concept of neurohumanities today.
We are breaking the ice on our head, yes. On our trail to the pole.
Right. So before we talk about the conference on neurohumanities and the NeuroSalon that is happening next month in April, right?
Yes, opening night, April 11.
So let me see if I can at least sort of bring some ideas together. Okay, so we talk about this entanglement, right, which is a word I've heard used with regard to this, which is good, between neuroscience and the humanities. And I see all sorts of possibilities. I see humanities as something, whether it's music, art, images, visual, even performance, we talked a bit about that. Its job is to go out there and engage and move people. But if you think about it, there's a neurological basis to that. So the neurosciences can help define or refine that so you can not only make humanities more moving and more engaging, you can take that idea, then put it back into science and engineering and try to help use it to improve technical education, improve our understanding and interpretation of even complex mathematical theory. Because if you think about it, when you sit down and you invent a new formula, a new model, you really think outside the box. I mean, Einstein did funny thought experiments of guys and rockets and light and things like that. The humanities helps science as well. So it's all that sort of thing. Here's what frightens me. Once you figure out how to move people in the cognitive basis of that, and you go back and forth and you understand everything, what's to prevent some mad scientist from Madison Avenue to say, take that and say, now we will achieve some 1984 utopian society where I can convince you and move you to buy whatever fizzy drink I want.
I don't understand why you think
there.
That hasn't happened.
Okay. I think we're already there, which is why those of us in the social science, humanities,
rats.
All of us who are citizens need to be aware of this.
Okay.
I think we're actually already there. I think that particularly in targeting the reward systems of the brain, mm-hmm. People... we're way beyond the hidden persuaders thesis. And that's what concerns me about filtering. I mean, you can filter out 9/10, if not 10/10 of
right.
lived experience, if you care
right.
to, and live in a fictitious world. So the question is, what brings you back and what makes you pay attention? I'm interested in a theory of creativity that actually, I think to be creative means that you actually are capable of paying deep attention to the world around you. Let me quote John Searle in this, the philosopher John Searle, who is, by the way, started out as an analytic philosopher, when he points out the importance of qualitative, what are called qualia, qualitative experiences. And I think one of the things that the visual arts can do is really provide you with this feeling of what it feels like, making you aware of what it feels like to be in a conscious state. And the importance of that, not just that it's another one damn experience after another, but that it is a vital experience to being a reputable citizen in the world, or to paraphrase Antonio Damasio, the feeling of what happens, that the arts provide the neurosciences with this phenomenological evidence for the complexity of the feeling of what happens and the importance of actually being alert and not just at the behest of some hidden persuaders who are targeting...
Isn't it necessary to filter things, though, just because there's too much to absorb? Isn't it necessary to filter things just because there's too much to absorb otherwise?
Of course we have to, and there are actually evolutionary reasons for it. I mean, you fight and flee, and you can't...
It's the same reason scientists make models.
No, but thing is, you need a healthy balance. Okay. In other words, we've kind of gone... I think we've gone over, and we continue to go with every new app that is, being invented, what they do is they tout personalizing media. But I would like to ask, what does that personalization really entail in terms of we sometimes have critiques of the tailorization of medicine. Yeah. I see a kind of...
And it's not always us personalizing
exactly.
It's someone else deciding
about the rest of the body? Yeah. That's an issue in tailorized medicine, for example. I mean, you can target, but since these are very complex interrelated systems, what about systematicity and thinking about the entire system? The other point I'd like to make, and maybe I didn't make strongly enough, I don't think that the arts are illustrations of complex scientific concepts. Some people talk about them that way. I think they instantiate them. And very famous scientists, Chandrasekhar, who's a wonderful astronomer at the University of Chicago, always said, Poincaré is another person, that actually he visualized very complex formula, that he actually had visions of them before he worked them out. Maybe the strongest thing that we can do is help scientists actually frame new questions, just as I think they help us frame our historical questions, our current questions differently. That's what I really would like to argue for.
So I would agree with that. And I think framing the question is something humanities really does. And by reframing the question, that's when you can formulate a new and novel solution in the sciences. That's exactly what Einstein did. Rather than saying, does gravity bend light? He said, no, the math works out better. And this doesn't seem intuitive, but the math works out better when you decide that gravity bends space and light follows space. It's a subtle difference, but it allowed him to come up with the most brilliant ideas ever. And you're right, the first name of an academic that you just mentioned that I recognize is Poincaré.
Yeah.
Right, because we do simulation, and he looks how to look at chaos and things like this.
Sure.
Very mathematical, but absolutely, the visualization helps you. And another good example on campus is Irving Geis. Irving Geis is an artist who draws biomolecules. And for you to appreciate the beauty and the symmetry of RNA or proteins or peptides, I can do them, you know, on a computer and give you geometries and XYZ coordinates of these things. But until you go over to the Institute for Bioscience and Bioengineering, where we have some of his donated artworks, and they appeared in my biochemistry book, and they are beautiful and inspiring, but very analytical as well, of biomolecules. So I agree. Framing the question is really how humanities helps the sciences.
And I think that...
And vice versa. I mean, that's what I mean about intellectual parity.
Yeah, yeah.
It has to be a two-way street, which means you actually have to understand each other at a fairly high level.
And we have an unconscious prejudice that we have to get over to be able to do this kind of stuff, because I think we learn early on that all of the scientists who were wrong were building stories. You know, when we talk about, Copernicus said Earth around the sun, and everyone said, no, that's wrong. And they described, you know, their beliefs as a narrative of science.
Yeah.
Everyone starts thinking, okay, so when you start telling a story, that's the sign that your science is wrong.
And right, that it's a fiction.
Exactly, and that data has to come and bust the story, and that's how science works, as opposed to the retelling and refining of the stories.
But 4 or 5 weeks ago, Randy Olson, the biologist-turned-filmmaker who made Flock of Dodos and Sizzle, a global warming comedy, said the way we engage the public in a discussion of science is with stories. And the problem with modern engineers and scientists, they are story-phobic.
Yeah.
Stories are something associated with the humanities. Boom! There it is. There's the callback. There's the closure. Yeah, I feel better now.
Are you the feature or the headliner?
I don't know what I am, but we need to mention a little bit about this conference that's
sure.
coming up. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, Sarah? Please. And everybody, please do come. We have a thematic neuro salon and a 2-day neuro humanities entanglement conference. People coming from everything from the new work on religion, the new performative on spirituality, the new spirituality in relationship to the neurosciences, to new work in music theory. You can think of the Brahms Project in Toronto, which involves actually the neurosciences, especially fundamental things like rhythm and what is danceability. So we actually span the gamut of fields where each speaker, each panel actually addresses a problem that could not really be resolved by one side or the other. So, for example, Martha Grover, who was involved in Emory, she was one of your colleagues, is running a wonderful panel on self-organization and self-assembly, which is, of course, very important.
She's the one that told me about you and your conference.
Oh, did she? Oh, that
Martha,
was very sweet
very
of
much.
Her. Thank you so much, Martha, too. Just to give that as a single example, that is a topic that absolutely is a common issue, the problem of self-assembly, self-organization, and again, pattern generation, involving people from computation. Steve Everett is going to be from music. So
and when all those
come.
Little elements like Steve Everett talked about in the program come together, they look simple, simple rule-based things, whether it's in music or sciences. Martha does self-organization of biomolecules and molecules on the surface. They come together, and then something new that is unexpected. We call it, you know, the wow factor in art, but it's emergent nonetheless, right? So weather patterns are emergent. Creativity is emergent. Art is emergent. And so is self-assembly of molecules, like what happened at the dawn of life on this planet, which is what Martha and her colleagues in the Center for Chemical Evolution study.
Yeah, we have, in other words, I wanted to get away from just the individual talk format, so we have three panels. We have a wonderful one, actually, on fiction and neuroscience.
Oh, yeah.
And
Lisa
that would
Yazzik.
Be by Lisa Yazyk, who also has
Go
a program.
Go, Lisa.
Sci-Fi
Lab.
Sci-Fi Lab, and she's appeared with us several times talking about the connection between science and science fiction.
Yeah, and actually with a commentator from Paris who is going to ask a question, what can literature mean today in this relationship? We have Ashok Goel, and who studies actually the role of images in autism, who's running a panel on visual cognition. And then we have these wonderful individual speakers, as I pointed out, the people who are looking at the new types of religion in relationship, you know, the Dalai Lama, meditative theory, new spirituality, to speaking of performance theory, a new kind of poetry. We're going to be touring Randy Engel's CABI, the Center for Brain Imaging. So please do come. It's going to be at Tech Square on Thursday and Friday, April 12th and 13th, our opening for the Neuro Salon, which actually are wonderful works that are collaborative works involving engineering and art. That actually speak to problems of perception, attentiveness, narcissism. That opens the night before in the College of Architecture Stubbins Studio, but the conference will begin sharp at 9 a.m. Thursday, Friday in TSRB at Tech Square, ground floor, plenty of parking for the general public.
And if anybody needs more information about this, is there a website?
Yes, we have a website. We have a link You can go, actually, we have a link both in the College of Architecture. If you go to their home page, there is a link.
coa.gontech.edu.
Thank you. And there's also a link at lcc.gontech.edu.
And there is a link at insidetheblackbox.org. So if you look up this show, you can actually find that as well. So we've reached the end of the program where we attempt to address the question, what have we learned?
Through an hour again.
So here's what we learned. We learned that we'll have you back probably next year to talk about where we've gone with the conference and things like that. But we certainly want to thank Barbara
Stafford
for coming here. My brain hurts at this point. That's why. For coming here
from
Georgia Tech.
He's holding on for dear life right now.
For being sufficiently ignorant of the fact that we are a bunch of egg-headed engineers who don't quite get all this stuff, but we're grateful for the fact that she did agree to come here. And I think what we've done today is outline the tremendous overlap between science, engineering, cognitive science, neuroscience, and the humanities, and how they can help each other in so many different ways, not the least of which is simply help frame the question in the other side. It actually has practical applications. So human-machine interfaces,
yes.
Some of that practical application we may have lost in the 70s. So that's why this field, it is something whose time
Georgie Kepish was the
come.
Example. Yeah.
That's exactly it. And what we realize is it can not only be used to deal with what did you call that? That 10% of selective attention?
Yes. Yeah.
Right? And there are already people using it in applications. And that, of course, would be marketing and advertising. But what you implied is that we can take this back, do the filtering that we want to do, not what search engines want us to do, and then maybe use it for good instead of evil, and maybe, you know, do better things other than trying to convince people to buy the next product on the Internet. So I thought that was fabulous. Did I leave
thank
anything
you.
Out?
No. You were
okay.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm a wayward thinker, so thank you very much for pulling it together.
And both Charlie and I are very divergent people as well, but I want to thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
And if any of our listeners have a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show here on Inside the Black Box, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt, and we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.